This is a coastal story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. In August 1874, a letter appeared in the Sheffield Daily Telegraph from Ralph Stott of the Railway Hotel, Buxton. It might not have been the most glamorous address, nor the highest profile media outlet, but the letter made quite a claim. After 12 years of careful experimenting, I have produced and now have in my possession an apparatus by which action and reaction are rendered opposite and unequal, and by which motion is produced without expenditure of motive power. It was a windy way of saying he'd invented a flying machine. The principle was simple. It didn't involve much beyond a certain arrangement of levers and a compressed spring small enough to be slipped into a jacket pocket. The spring was the crucial piece of kit, instrumental in the basic principle powering his machine, controlling air pressure. Stott went on to give a lengthy description of the science he'd employed, but not in enough detail for anyone to produce the machine themselves. Ralph Stott not only had a big idea, he had big plans for his big idea. In testing the device, he had attached himself to the apparatus, risen 100 feet into the air, and travelled a full 15 miles in 10 minutes into a strong wind. I also ascended, descended, remained stationary in mid-air, steered, in fact, tested it with everything which would be required for aerial navigation, with perfect success. He was willing to part with his invention, but it would cost £1,000 up front and a percentage of all future proceeds. The paper's editor replied with his tongue stuck so firmly into his cheek it must have taken a sink plunger to get it out again. Our correspondent's ability to rise 100 feet in the air and then go 15 miles in 10 minutes against a gale is just the thing we want for our reporters, he wrote. By the aid of such invention, we could also distribute the Sheffield Daily Telegraph every morning to great admiration. The compressed spring is the ideal article desired by Sheffield men who wish to start in pursuit of runaway debtors. It will save armies a great deal of marching, and when, as at Waterloo, the opposing forces are about to trample down fields of standing corn, the farmer can say, "Gentlemen, do please spare property. Oblige by fighting 100 feet in the air." The letter proved irresistible to other papers too. One commented, "A few more stories like this would help wonderfully to relieve the tedium of the big gooseberry season," while another cast doubt on the validity of Scott's basic science. "If it means anything, it suggests a feat like getting into a wheelbarrow and wheeling oneself, with the added difficulty of overcoming the force of gravity and rising into the air." Ralph Stott went quiet. Then, a few months later, he popped up in the Leeds Mercury, complaining that his previous efforts had been met with culpable apathy and indifference. He had since conducted further experiments, including raising his machine into the air and leaving it there for 4 days. Then he travelled 80 miles in an hour, with the machine only running at half power. He'd written with these incredible developments to the War Office Balloon Committee, the Royal Geographical Society, the Admiralty, and Benjamin Disraeli himself. But instead of gushing praise and offers of money, all he'd had in return were acknowledgements of receipt. He hadn't patented the machine because he'd been told that what he had was a scientific principle, and you couldn't patent a principle. Not only that, as Stott understood it, he couldn't display or demonstrate his invention either, not unless a considerable sum of money was paid to him, equivalent to the value of the longest term a patent could run. Otherwise, he would lose all rights of ownership to his own invention. His hands were tied, basically, unless and until someone ponied up a big bag of cash with his name on it. He insisted this was quite the opportunity for an adventurous investor, not least because his invention would apply not just to his own flying machine, but to ships and trains and trams. A ship need never sink again. If in danger of foundering, all they had to do was adjust the controls from horizontal to vertical, and hey presto, goodbye Davy Jones's locker. He offered interviews to newspapers at £20 a pop, paid in advance. He also said he would take his machine up in the air and travel 400 miles in 5 hours for £250, paid in advance. He was willing to build a second identical machine and sell that, complete with instructions, for a cool £1,000, paid in advance. It was a bit like a Victorian Patreon. Ralph Stott was born in 1839 in what's now Sri Lanka, the son of a Methodist minister. He first turned up in England in 1861, living in Greenwich and giving his occupation as gymnast. He married in Birmingham in 1865, and 5 years later, with his wife Eleanor, was living in a boarding house in Birkenhead, having effected a career change from gymnastics to mechanical engineering. From there, the Stotts moved to Leeds, then, in 1876, arrived in Dover, moving into a large house on the edge of the town. In August that year, Stott announced his intention to unveil his machine in public for the first time. Not only that, he would use it to cross the English Channel, flying from Dover to Calais and back inside an hour, no matter the force or direction of the wind. He clearly had a keen eye for the main chance. A few months earlier, Captain Matthew Webb had become the first person to swim the Channel, becoming in an instant the nation's hottest celebrity. Crossing the same expanse in a flying machine, propelled by new technology that would revolutionise the world, well, that was another level altogether. Letters to newspapers were no longer enough. For the first time, Stott published drawings and even a photograph of his contraption. In the pictures, he and another man sat opposite each other in what appeared to be an open rectangular wooden box, a bit like the basket of a hot air balloon. The only thing that differentiated the image from two fellas sitting in a kind of cut-and-shut commode was the device between them topped by a small wheel. This contained the entirety of Stott's technology. Everything necessary for propulsion, lift, acceleration and braking was there, under a horizontal steering wheel. No wings, no propeller, no rudder, no fuel tank. Just two blokes sitting in a box. One contemporary report described it as looking like a bath with a churn at its centre, a kind of aerial washing machine. The price had gone up considerably in the intervening 2 years. Stott now wanted £4,000 up front for just 5% of future profits. He covered Dover with posters announcing the flight, which would take place on the 9th of October 1876 from the Royal Cinque Ports Yacht Club in the town. He would fly above Dover so everyone got a good look, then glide over the Channel to Calais and return inside an hour, a round trip of just over 40 miles. Excitement grew throughout September. Reporters began arriving and booking into hotels. Stott was seen pacing up and down Admiralty Pier, looking across to France, deep in thought. Then, with 2 weeks to go before the big event, he announced he was off to Germany with his machine. None other than Otto von Bismarck himself, the President of Prussia, had summoned him to Berlin for a demonstration with a view to purchase. Take that, War Department Balloon Committee. Not to worry, though. While he wouldn't be travelling using his device, he'd still be back in plenty of time for the Dover-Calais demonstration, even if Bismarck chose to buy his machine, because if Ralph Stott was anything, it was a man of his word. Pausing only to add that he'd just turned down an offer of £2,000 just to watch him raise his machine from the ground, because he'd promised Bismarck first dibs, he boxed up his invention, loaded it onto a steamer, and set off across the Channel. On the 3rd of October 1876, 6 days ahead of the demonstration, Stott wrote from Berlin saying that early discussions with the Prussians had been promising. Their government had committed to paying a large fee and all expenses on condition that a trial, which hadn't happened yet, proved a success. Success meant that, if by means of the machine a sufficient height above the surface of the earth can be attained necessary for reconnaissance in times of war, and can be moved in contrary directions to the currents of the air. Not only that, Stott had met a Russian aristocrat in Berlin who was so taken with the idea, he'd hot-footed it to St. Petersburg to tell the Tsarist government about it, and would return with some top brass to see a demonstration. There was disappointing news too, alas. In consequence of unavoidable delay in seeing certain personages here, he wrote, the Calais flight would be postponed until November. 2 weeks later, the Morning Post published an update from their Berlin correspondent. Mr. Ralph Stott, the aeronaut from Dover, who has lately made himself an object of much discussion here by his flying machine, has suddenly resorted to every possible excuse to disengage himself from the obligations entered into. His assent before certain delegates of the War Office is revoked because the government refused to pay him immediately a sum of £1,000. Then news came back from Germany that the Berlin demonstration would not take place until November. Stott then set his Channel attempt for the following spring, on the 5th of March 1877. In January, he reappeared in Dover. Bismarck had cooled on the idea, given Stott's apparent reluctance to demonstrate his machine, while still demanding large sums of money up front. But it wasn't all bad. This meant he could now focus on his Channel crossing. A few weeks before the March date, however, wouldn't you know it, he was called abroad again. His St. Petersburg contact had arranged a demonstration for him at the Imperial Russian Naval Academy. It meant the Channel crossing would again be postponed, but it would happen as soon as he got back. This was January. There was no further word until May, and even that wasn't from Stott himself. It turned out that when he left Berlin, he'd done a bunk from the hotel in which he'd stayed for several weeks, leaving behind a substantial unpaid bill. He'd left the flying machine as security, but had taken the keys with him. Did anyone know where he was? The hotel wondered. Whether Ralph Stott actually went to St. Petersburg isn't clear. It turned out that he was actually a very sick man. He'd said in his first letter to the Sheffield Daily Telegraph that his health was restricting progress with his machine, which is partly why he was prepared to sell it. On Boxing Day 1877, Ralph Stott died in Weybridge, Cornwall, of tuberculosis. He was 38 years old. Was he a con man or a crackpot? If he was just at it, did he know he was dying and wanted to provide for his family's future, even if that meant hornswoggling the President of Prussia himself? Either way, as Ralph Stott was buried on a freezing day in a Cornish churchyard, hundreds of miles away, in the basement of a Berlin hotel, there was a box containing a wooden contraption with two seats, a system of levers, a spring, and a steering wheel that would never, ever leave the ground. That was A Coastal Story. I'm Charlie Connolly. There are more Channel stories in my forthcoming book called The Channel, published at the end of June by Orion. If you fancied pre-ordering it online, that would be dandy. I'm on Twitter at Charlie Connolly, and you can join the Coastal Story fun on Facebook by searching Coastal Stories Podcast. If you're enjoying these stories, do tell people about them. Tweet about it, tell people on Facebook, and if you're so inclined, rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts. They won't fly you across the channel, but they won't cost you a grand up front either.